Welcome to the Science Podcast for May 31st, 2013. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Stuart Wills. This week, strengthening the world's strongest material, the radiation exposure of a trip to Mars, and tackling India's poverty with technology.
India helped find water on the moon, but ironically, India is unable to provide clean, potable drinking water to its people.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org. This podcast is also sponsored by Audible.com, home to over 100,000 audiobooks.
Graphene is a super strong material made up of carbon, specifically a one atom thick sheet of it. A square meter of graphene weighs less than 1 milligram. It's so thin, it's essentially two-dimensional. It's got all sorts of potential applications involving thin and flexible electronics, but before we can get there, we first need to figure out how to produce it efficiently. Scientists have developed a method for creating pristine, defect-free graphene, but scaling this process up introduces potential points of weakness. Jeffrey Kaiser and colleagues put a few forms of graphene to the test to determine just how strong they are. Kaiser spoke with me about the findings and their implications in the development of so-called low-dimensional materials.
Graphene is a material that has been intensely studied over the past 5 or 6 years. It has a tremendous amount of potential because of its unique properties. Our previous work in 2008 showed that graphene in its pristine form, and by that I mean graphene that has no defects in it, is the strongest material that's ever been characterized. In fact, it can attain what is called its intrinsic strength, or the maximum theoretical strength that a material can achieve. In our current work, the fundamental question is whether graphene that contains defects in it can also achieve the ultra-high strength, at least approaching that of the pristine graphene. And the results of our study suggest that, yes, indeed, graphene that contains defects can achieve an ultra-high strength as well.
Okay, so what exactly does it mean when you say that graphene is one of the strongest materials known? Does that mean that if I were to take a sheet, I couldn't shatter it, I couldn't rip it, things like that?
By the strength, we refer to the maximum force per unit area, or in the case of graphene, since it's a two-dimensional material, the force per unit length that the material can support. And so graphene, for a given amount of the material, can support a larger force than any other material.
And being a single layer of atoms, what does graphene look like? If I were to hold up a sheet that was, say, a meter square, would I actually be able to see it?
Graphene is transparent. If you simply would be able to hold up a sheet and see it, it would be largely transparent. The atomic structure of graphene is exactly like a chicken wire or a honeycomb in which all of the atoms are arranged in hexagons. And so if one looks at it through special microscopes, a scanning tunneling microscope, for example, one is able to see the atomic structure and confirm that it is in the form of these hexagons.
And what is graphene used for?
To date, it has not been incorporated into many devices, but given the fact that it is the strongest material that has been characterized, it gives us some interesting information because it tells us what is possible in terms of designing materials. So many people are developing composite materials that contain graphene in order to attempt to take advantage of the immense strength of graphene. The hope is to develop composites with unique properties as well that do not exist in nature. Another area of immense promise is in the field of flexible electronics. So imagine a piece of paper or a piece of plastic that could fold up and be put into your wallet, but that would be your cell phone or could show pictures on it. For example, in the science fiction of Harry Potter, the characters had newspapers that had moving images on it.
Hmm.
And so being able to incorporate graphene as an electrode in the flexible electronics would be a step in that direction.
So graphene's strength can partly be attributed to the fact that it is so thin. And in your paper, you quite nicely summarize the differences between low-dimensional materials like graphene and three-dimensional bulk materials. So why are ultra-thin materials like graphene so strong, and what are the dangers of scaling up?
So graphene is so strong for two reasons. One is because it is constructed entirely out of carbon atoms through covalent bonding, and the carbon-covalent bonds are considered to be some of the strongest there are. Now, in order to be able to achieve the great strength, the graphene needs to have a very low density of defects in it. One of the reasons why a two-dimensional material can achieve its great strength is because there are fewer options or different types of defects that can exist. All of the atoms in graphene, for example, exist on the surface, and in that sense, it's a true two-dimensional material. So by definition, there can be no bulk defects. There can be no holes inside the volume or other types of defects. Also, many of the defects in a 3D bulk material are introduced by surface damage. And so essentially what we've done in our study is to learn how to avoid the introduction of surface damage. And since there are, by definition, no bulk defects that can exist, then the material can be relatively free of defects.
So in this study, you're essentially comparing the strength of pristine graphene to that of graphene produced with defects in the form of grain boundaries, crystal boundaries. You tested their relative strengths using a process called nanoindentation, in which you basically poked the graphene with a diamond-pointed nanoneedle at various forces and measured what happened. So using this method, how did these two forms of graphene fare? Which was stronger?
The pristine graphene, of course, can attain its intrinsic strength, but the graphene that is grown by chemical vapor deposition, as long as the processing parameters are such that it does not damage the material, it can achieve up to 80 or 90% of the strength of the pristine defect-free graphene.
So what you found essentially is that the grain boundaries, these defects themselves, don't actually significantly weaken the graphene. But in cases where we've observed weaker graphene in real life, it might have been because of other processes acting on these defects.
Yes. Others had found that graphene was substantially weaker than the pristine graphene, but part of that could have been due to the processing parameters that were used, which in essence etched away part of the grain boundaries and left really islands of graphene rather than well-stitched grains of graphene. So one can think of the graphene that one gets from chemical vapor deposition as being similar to a quilt, in the sense that you have a number of different grains or sheets of graphene, and by ensuring that the boundaries are strong, then one can achieve the ultra-high strength of even polycrystalline graphene.
So how do we avoid processes that damage the graphene, especially that with defects? How can we keep from weakening it after producing it?
Well, the atoms that exist in a grain boundary between two grains of graphene are in a higher energy state than the atoms within a grain. And as a consequence, they are more prone to interact with chemicals in the environment. For example, they would oxidize sooner, or they would etch away sooner in the presence of an acid or another etchant. So the key is simply to find etchants and other chemicals that are used in the processes that do not cause chemical reactions with the atoms in the grain boundaries.
So does this sort of study have any broader implications across material science and industrial manufacturing?
It certainly does, I think, especially for the processing of two-dimensional materials. Graphene is only one of many different two-dimensional materials that can exist. Another that we've looked at is molybdenum disulfide, which is a trilayer of atoms in which there is a molybdenum layer of atoms sandwiched between two sulfur layers of atoms. And the take-home message from our study here is that if one has a two-dimensional material, which is literally only one atom or maybe two or three atoms thick, if you damage the surface, you've damaged the entire material.
Mm-hmm.
So two-dimensional materials are highly sensitive to processing because if you damage the surface, you're damaging the entire material because there is no material in the bulk.
Okay, well, Jeffrey Kaiser, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for your time. It's very much appreciated.
Jeffrey Kaiser and colleagues write about manufacturing high-strength graphene in a report this week.
Hey, podcast listeners. This week's show is sponsored by Audible. And right now, they're offering you a special deal. If you go to audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag, you can get a free audiobook of your choice.
And if you're looking for any ideas, I'm going to offer up another book by Amy Stewart. This one called The Drunken Botanist, The Plants That Create the World's Great Drinks. Any liquor you can think of, she's found the plant that gives rise to it.
So check out that book and more from Audible. And don't forget, you can get a free download just for signing up at audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag. Out in space, away from the umbrella of the Earth's atmosphere and the magnetic shielding provided by the Van Allen belts, radiation from all directions creates an inhospitable environment for humans. But how inhospitable? Sarah Crespi spoke with Carrie Zeitlin about radiation levels measured on the Curiosity rover's trip to Mars and what it might mean for sending humans to the Red Planet.
When the Mars Science Laboratory was first designed, NASA knew they wanted to put a particle detector on board so we could measure radiation on the surface of Mars for precursor measurement for future human exploration. And in the process of getting things ready to go to Mars on our instrument team, we realized that it would be really interesting to measure on the way there. So we suggested to the project folks at JPL that they turn our instrument on early in the trip and let us stay on as much as possible. And they agreed. As it turned out, they gave us a lot of support. They were fully behind this idea that we could get a pretty good idea of the radiation dose that a human crew might get on a trip to Mars.
What kinds of radiation might one encounter between here and Mars, and what are their effects on humans?
It's a really complicated question, but basically, once you get outside the influence of the Earth's magnetic field, which happens very shortly after launch on a trip like this, you're into deep space, and there are two types of energetic particle radiation that are of concern for humans and also, I should mention, for electronic equipment.
Mm-hmm.
The first type are called galactic cosmic rays. We abbreviate that often to just calling them GCRs. And the other kind are solar energetic particles that come from solar flares and coronal mass ejections. And both of them can present risks to humans, but probably the more difficult one to deal with is the galactic cosmic rays. They are very high energy particles and very difficult to shield against. They can typically go through several inches of solid matter shielding without being attenuated very much. So astronauts in deep space will get a continuous low radiation dose from them. The concern is not so much any immediate effects on people, although those are possible, but long-term health effects like cancer or damage to the central nervous system.
So we have two kinds of radiation here, cosmic radiation and radiation that originates from the sun. Which is easier to predict? What can we plan around?
Well, actually, the galactic cosmic rays are pretty predictable, and they are continuous over time. They vary, sort of overall intensity varies by factor of two, factor of three over the 11-year solar cycle.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, the harder thing to predict are the solar particle events that the sun spits out. We don't have a great ability to predict those going forward. We only know kind of in a rough way from where we are in the 11-year cycle what the probabilities are for big events, but you can't predict individual events very well at all.
Mm-hmm. So why is it that we can predict cosmic radiation, and that is linked to the solar cycle, but we can't predict the sun-generated radiation?
Basically, that 11-year cycle of sunspots that people have known about for centuries, just from observing the sun through optical telescopes, mm-hmm. that also corresponds with changes in the solar magnetic field. So when there are more sunspots, the magnetic field is stronger. And the magnetic field actually has a shielding effect against some of the cosmic rays coming into the inner heliosphere. Mm-hmm. So when you have high sunspot number, you're more likely to get solar flares and coronal mass ejections, these things that accelerate the energetic particles from the sun. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's actually reducing the intensity of the cosmic rays that are coming in from outside.
Interesting.
You can think of the heliosphere as sort of, at least in some sense, a big magnetic bubble.
Right.
And the strength of that kind of waxes and wanes with the solar cycle.
Really cool. So let's talk about the measurements that you took from this trip. What kind of data came back?
Well, our instrument is designed to measure energetic particles. So that means that we do a pretty good job measuring the cosmic rays and any energetic particles that the sun might spit out while we're on the way. And in fact, we did see a handful of solar events that were quite interesting, being in interplanetary space in between Earth and Mars. There are a lot of measurements of those particle events made by instruments in or near Earth, and not so many measurements made farther out. So the solar events were quite interesting. And also, we got good data on the dose from galactic cosmic rays under a lot of shielding, and that hadn't been done before.
Mm-hmm. So is the shielding in this spacecraft similar to what goes on a crewed spacecraft?
In sort of an average sense, yes. But the specifics in this case were a little different, because I don't know if you or your listeners would remember the details of this landing sequence that was kind of extraordinarily complicated and wildly successful, but there was a lot of complicated mass around the rover. Up above it, there was a shell, a parachute, that
right.
sky crane device, and the descent stage included fuel tanks, mm-hmm. and on the bottom there was a heat shield. So really a complicated mass distribution around our instrument. And it turned out there were some places that were actually quite lightly shielded, where particles could come in just through that outer shell. And if you were designing a spacecraft for humans, you would want to make it more sort of uniformly shielded and not have so many places where the shielding was light.
Hmm. How does the exposure, these exposures that you saw in this trip, compare with what astronauts have encountered in other missions?
That's a really good question. I had the advantage that you had asked me this question before we spoke. I had to go and look it up. But what I found was the largest astronaut doses so far that anybody's gotten were on the Skylab mission back in the mid-1970s, and some people got up to 180 millisieverts of radiation, and that's millisievert is the unit of exposure used to evaluate risk. Now, if you take that 180 millisieverts that some of those people got and you divide it by the number of days they were in space, the actual dose rate was really pretty close to what we measured in deep space, which was interesting. But the trip to Mars takes a lot longer. Those folks on Skylab were up for, I think, a maximum of 85 days. And in the mission scenarios that people talk about for sending people to Mars, you would need to spend about a year overall in interplanetary space. So you'd get a lot more just from the time of the exposure.
Interesting. Overall, what do these results mean for future missions? Shielding, time in space, that kind of thing.
Right. Well, one of the interesting things about space radiation is the galactic cosmic rays in particular are really difficult to shield against. Shielding helps a little, but not a tremendous amount. So given that there's a very high cost of launching mass, there's no way anybody's ever going to launch some super massive amount of shielding to protect people. So the best thing we could do really is to get there faster, which would require some other means of propulsion. If anybody listening to this has ever taken a radiation safety training class, you get told three things. First, if you're around a source, you maximize your distance from the source. Mm-hmm. Second, you put shielding between yourself and the source. And third, you minimize your time near it. Now, in space, the source is everywhere, so you can't maximize your distance from it, so that part doesn't apply. And then shielding doesn't really help that much. And the only thing that's left of those three is shortening the time.
All right, Cary Zeitlin, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Cary Zeitlin and colleagues write about radiation exposure on the way to Mars in a report this week.
The summer of 2013 is bringing a changing of the guard at Science. Not only is long-term news editor Colin Norman moving on, but it's time for our editor-in-chief Bruce Alberts to step down and pass the torch to Marcia McNutt. Magna Sachdev interviewed Alberts about his tenure at Science. Here's an excerpt of their discussion.
So the reason why I decided to step down for Science Magazine is not only, I think, 5 years is long enough, a fresh new view would be useful to Science Magazine, but personally for me, I feel that I want to use my connections and my prestige to try to make a difference in redefining what we mean by the term science education.
You can listen to the whole interview and read the editorial by Bruce Alberts at www.sciencemag.org.
Smartphones can be used for a lot more than a call or text message. They can also be used, say, to run small portable diagnostics labs, to give farmers minute-by-minute updates on crop prices, or to check in at the local deli. Sarah Crespi spoke with Pallava Bagla about how modern technologies like smartphones, tablets, and biometrics are being deployed in India with the lofty goals of alleviating poverty and strengthening democracy.
India has one-third of the world's poor. India is the world's largest democracy, but there are 400 million people who live on less than $1.25 a day. Compared to US, if you see, which has a population of 313 million. So there are more poor people living in India than the entire population of the United States of America. So this story on the science for all, targeting how science is helping the poor, is appropriately placed here.
Well, can you talk more specifically about some of the big problems that India is facing that technology might help to solve?
India today spends about $12 billion on research and development, which is about 1% of the GDP. But at the same time, 400 million people are living below the poverty line. So there are many problems in India which can be addressed through science and technology, providing potable drinking water, affordable healthcare, affordable housing, and importantly, empowering people so that democracy becomes more and more entrenched.
Mm-hmm.
Now, education is one big place where technology is making a big impact. And in education, India is trying to develop what would be the world's cheapest computer tablet. It's a tablet called Akash. Most likely, it will be priced at under $50 per tablet.
Mm-hmm.
This particular computer is enabled to work with Wi-Fi and would at some point be a replacement for textbooks for schools and colleges. Just about half the children go to school. So if you have better learning experience, more and more children are likely to go to school. And the Akash tablet, which is being pioneered by the Indian Institute of Technology Madras and the Indian Institute of Technology Bombay, could be a game changer.
Well, some of the other ideas you talk about in your piece focus on cell phones. How could those be used to both distribute information and collect it?
Cell phones are ubiquitous in India.
Mm-hmm.
India may be poor, but Indians love mobile phones and cell phones. There are today, for a 1.2 billion population, there are 900 million mobile phones, which is a huge number.
Yes.
In fact, the former environment minister made a very pertinent point. There are more mobile phones in India than toilets, which is ironical. But at the same time, mobile phone connectivity is offering a very new way of solving problems for people. It is giving opportunity for access to what can be called telemedicine.
Mm-hmm.
India has a very large farming community, and farmers are using smartphones to track pests and diseases and reach scientists to get solutions for what can be done.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the most important pests today, which is of concern, is a rust which grows on wheat called UG99. Scientists are getting connected to farmers to try and track whether UG99 has made an entry in India.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, it has not till now.
Well, you mentioned telemedicine and how cell phones might serve to help people, but there's also more medical tracks being taken, for example, in vaccine development. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Vaccines are a very important way of providing affordable health care. And every third child in the world today takes in one or the other vaccine which has been manufactured in India. A very recent development in India is the development of the rotavirus vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
Rotavirus causes diarrhea, and it is a menace in India. It causes about 100,000 deaths of young children every year. A new vaccine which has been developed by an Indian group, manufactured by an Indian company, is now hitting the market.
Mm-hmm.
The phase 3 clinical trials were announced just last month, and they were successful. And this particular vaccine called Rotavax is going to be priced at under $1 per dose.
Mm-hmm.
It's an oral vaccine given in a sequence of 3 doses. The comparable vaccine by a multinational company in India cost 40 times more.
Wow.
So affordable vaccines can make a big difference. If this Rotavax can be used and it can save 100,000 deaths of children every year, it can be a big, big game changer as far as affordable healthcare goes for the country.
Mm-hmm. So another interesting point that you mention in your story is that just keeping track of all the people, identifying them and keeping track of them could actually help alleviate poverty. Can you talk about that?
Yes, India is a population of 1.2 billion people,
mm-hmm.
the second most populous country in the world after China. Very soon it will overtake China. But many people grow up without ever having official proper identification. The name is the best identification in India, but in 21st century, that is not good enough.
Mm-hmm.
You need a photo ID which can be verified. So there is this very unique project which has been launched by the Indian government called the Unique Identification Project, in which every resident in India is going to be given a random 12-digit number. So this particular number is generated using and captures the biometrics.
Mm-hmm.
The biometrics include a photograph, an iris scan of both the eyes, and a 10-finger fingerprint. So it is as foolproof as it can be. And this whole thing is then stored in a database which is online. And when people need to access and get themselves verified, all they have to do is place their finger on a scanner or get their iris scanned. And once you've had yourself registered in this database, you can be identified. So what is going to happen is that the subsidies which are today given to the poor people by mm-hmm. the government of India are flowing through the government channels,
mm-hmm.
which, like many other places, is very leaky and highly corruption-ridden. So if there is money which can flow directly to the local people, the poor people, then this direct cash transfer could help reduce the corruption which happens and help alleviate poverty.
Mm-hmm.
So this particular number project is going to be one of the largest in the world. And till date, it has registered about 300 million people in its database and is likely to include the entire resident population of India and would be a big boon, simply giving people an identity which can be authenticated mm-hmm. digitally and online.
And what's the timeline for that?
300 million people have been done in the last 2 years,
mm-hmm.
and they want to do another 200 million people in the next 2 years. So there is going to be a lag phase there, because getting everybody on a database like this is not easy.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very ambitious project, one of its kind in the world, and is being implemented with great sincerity by a team of dedicated scientists and engineers.
Well, so lastly, I want to talk about why there's this focus on technical solutions. I mean, some people would argue that legislation and political change could do something to change the status of people in India. Why focus on the technical?
See, every society as it grows, and especially in the 21st century, almost every society is dependent on some kind of input from science and technology.
Mm-hmm.
Without technological intervention, it is very difficult for any society to survive. And at India's development path today, the key phrase is inclusive growth. So if you have to have inclusive growth, which is to reach the poorest people mm-hmm. and reach anyone who's needy, technological solutions offer a very fine way of both empowering people increasing the level of democracy in the country, and in the end, getting more money in the hands of people.
Mm-hmm.
But remember, technology is not the panacea. If you recall, India, when it launched its maiden mission to the moon in 2008 called Chandrayaan 1, India helped find water on the moon. But ironically, India is unable to provide clean, potable drinking water to its people. So science and technology offer solutions, but only when they are implemented in a very big way and with the right political will behind it.
Mm.
So this particular story about science for all is really about how science and technology is helping to empower people, people who don't have the right information to make the right decisions.
Well, Pallava Bagla, thanks so much for talking with me.
My pleasure.
Pallava Bagla is a contributing correspondent for Science. He writes about technical initiatives in India in a News Focus this week.
Finally today, I'm Carrie Klein, and I'm here with online news editor David Grimm, who is going to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. So in our first story today, Dave, we're learning a little bit about why senior moments happen.
Right, Carrie, this story is about the cognitive decline that happens with age. We forget where our keys are. We maybe don't think as quickly as we used to. There are a variety of reasons this happens. This new study pinpoints a reason that's only recently come to light and provides some evidence for it. It has to do with something called microbleeding, which is the bursting of small blood vessels in the brain. You lose blood flow to a particular region because of this, and then tissue dies, and then you lose cognitive function.
Now, how would these microbleeds happen in the first place?
Well, the brain is a very blood-hungry organ. Even though it only accounts for about 2% of our body weight, it receives 15% of our cardiac output and consumes 20% of our oxygen. So it's a very hungry organ. But rather than getting this oxygen in pulses, the brain needs a smooth, continuous supply. So the aorta, which is the largest blood vessel that branches off the heart, smooths out the blood pressure before it reaches the brain by absorbing the pressure within its flexible walls. But as people age, their aorta stiffens. This translates into higher blood pressure in the brain, especially during stress. And the higher the blood pressure, you're more likely you are to have these bursting vessels and these microbleeds and theoretically the cognitive decline that goes along with them.
So the brain actually experiences a different blood pressure than the rest of the body?
It does. And it gets higher as we get older. Still leaves open the question, well, does that actually account for cognitive decline?
Right.
And that's what this new study is all about. What the researchers did was they recruited about 500 people in Melbourne, Australia. These people were from about 20 to 82 years old. And they measured what's called the central blood pressure. This is the blood pressure that is tied to the aorta and is actually what's happening in the brain. This is not to be confused with the brachial pressure, which is the type of blood pressure you get when they put that cuff on your arm in the doctor's office. And what the researchers found was that central blood pressure and the stiffness of the aorta correlated very well with a person's cognitive abilities, so that the higher their central blood pressure and the higher the stiffness of their aorta, the worse these people tended to perform on tests of visual processing and memory. So although it's just a correlation, it's really the strongest evidence yet that this central blood pressure and specifically the microbleeds that are caused by high central blood pressure may be responsible for a lot of the cognitive decline that we experience as we get older.
So if this aorta stiffness, higher blood pressure, and microbleeds are really what's leading to cognitive decline in older age, what can we do about it?
Well, one of the authors is working on whether a dietary supplement might do the trick. He proposes that the elasticity of the aorta could be preserved by maybe providing some fatty acids or antioxidants that help maintain its structure.
Hmm.
Maybe you'd just be able to take a vitamin, and that would help to stave off cognitive decline. That's pretty far away, but at least one potential avenue for therapy.
Wow, how interesting. And our next story is a little bit less optimistic. It's about what happens to whales that get stuck in fishing gear.
That's right, Carrie. This story is really about how even whales that are freed from fishing gear may still be doomed to die. And it centers on a whale that was named EG3911 that was spotted on Christmas Day of 2010 by a team of wildlife spotters. And what was the problem with this whale is she was actually caught up in 132 meters of commercial fishing rope. And this isn't an unusual problem for whales. Whales, especially in the North Atlantic, can become tied up in heavy-duty commercial fishing lines, and even lobsters and crab traps, anything that's connected to the surface by long ropes. The whales can get tangled in there. They're not able to move around. They're not able to dive, and so they're not able to feed. It's actually a leading cause of death for Atlantic whales going back to 1970. But this new study asks a question of, you know, even if these whales are freed, how do they fare? And the reason they ask that question is because EG3911 was freed, but by the time she was freed, she was 20% thinner than other right whales her age. And as soon as she was freed, she seemed like she was okay. She began swimming faster and diving deeper. But the problem was she had no way to bulk back up. These whales normally feed in cool northern waters during the summer, and the winter waters, by the time she was freed, had no food sources left for her. So she's tired, she's hungry, she's skinny, and she's not able to get the food that she needs because she's too far away from it. And indeed, just a few weeks later, she was found dead, sporting lethal shark attack wounds. The researchers suspect that she was sort of lethargically bobbing up at the surface. She was basically easy prey for predators. But they really wanted to figure out, why did this whale die and why might other whales die even after they're free? And they actually took a lot of the same gear that she was trapped in, and they dragged it behind a boat to figure out how much drag these traps were generating on the whale's body. And what they found is that EG3911 was burning up to twice as much energy as she would have normally while she was entangled. And that made her not only lose a lot of weight, but really sort of exhaust herself, so that even when she was free, she really wasn't able to get to where she needed to go to replenish her energy stores, replenish her food stores.
Wow.
And that's probably why she became so lethargic and became a victim of sharks.
So it sounds like getting entangled in this fishing gear, while the experience itself may not be lethal, it's just totally wiping these whales out and permanently weakening them.
Right. As one of the outside experts says, the impact of humanity on these creatures does not end when they go out of sight.
And moving on, our third story is about the social smarts of man's best friend.
That's right, Carrie. Dogs have changed a lot since they were domesticated from wolves. They're comfortable around us. They pay close attention to us. They follow orders most of the time. These are things that wolves don't do. And so scientists have usually said that dogs are socially smarter than wolves. They deal better in social situations. They have a lot of social intuition that wolves don't have. And it's because of the social intuition that they've become such a close companion of man. But this new study debunks that a bit.
So in the past, we've had a little bit of a human-centric notion that things that behave more like us maybe are a little bit socially smarter.
Right. And one of the big tests that researchers have used is this so-called pointing task. When you point your finger at, say, a cup that maybe has a treat under it, and there's maybe some other cups nearby, dogs typically look at what you're pointing at, and they were able to find the treat, whereas wolves really fail miserably at this test. And so that's been evidence that dogs have a so-called theory of mind, which is sort of an ability to intuit what we're thinking. When we point at something, that means we want the dog to go there, whereas wolves don't have that. But what these researchers found, these were researchers who were studying wolves and dogs at the Wolf Science Center, which is outside Vienna in Austria. They found that there were instances where wolves actually did better than dogs in social situations. For example, when they threw out some food for a pack of wolves or a pack of dogs, even though the wolves fought each other a lot, every wolf got a little bit of the food. They were able to work together enough that they were all able to get some food. Whereas with dogs, the alpha dog really monopolized the food source. He got all the food to himself, and the other dogs didn't get anything. And the researchers actually devised an experiment to further test the social smarts of wolves and dogs. What they did was they locked a food treat inside a box, and then they taught a dog how to open the box. And then they had a bunch of wolves or a bunch of dogs watch this dog open the box. So theoretically, they could learn how to open the box and get the food by watching this dog. And what they found was that the wolves were very good at this. All of the wolves were able to open the box, and most of them were able to do it by using the same method the trainer dog had used, whereas the dogs were miserable at this task. Most of them couldn't open the box, and the few that did didn't do it the same way the trainer dog had done, which suggests that they weren't even learning from this dog how to do it.
So perhaps there's more than one kind of social intelligence here. There's learning from others of your own species, and there's learning from humans, the ones that have trained you and domesticated you.
Exactly. And that's what the researchers say. There isn't really one type of social intelligence. As you pointed out earlier, we tend to be a little bit biased that, you know, animals that act a little bit more like us, we consider them smarter. Where in this case, for wolves, it makes a lot more sense for them to be socially smart with other wolves because those are the animals they deal with for the vast majority of their lives. So they've got to learn from each other. Whereas with dogs, they don't really have to learn that well from each other because really the creature they're spending most of the time with is us.
So it seems like the dogs have sort of traded off one kind of sociability for another.
Exactly.
All right. And what else have we had on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Carrie, for Science Now, we've got a controversial story about what may be the earliest bird fossil ever found and how it may shed light on how dinosaurs became birds, although there's some questions about the provenance of the fossil. There's also a cool story about predicting autism with some new genetic tests. And for Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about whether one scientist is hampering the fight against a lethal new virus by patenting it. Also a story about a kerfuffle over lavish furnishings at a Texas cancer center that was having financial problems. Finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's Science Live is about the ethics of studying chimpanzees in captivity. And next week's Science Live is about the challenges of human exploration of Mars. And we'll have a very special guest, Buzz Aldrin, the second man on the moon. So definitely tune in for that. Both of these are video chats. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
Great. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Carrie.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out all of our news at news.sciencemag.org, including daily stories from Science Now, Science Policy from Science Insider, and Science Live, live chats on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the May 31st, 2013 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Stuart Wills.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.